Welcome to the Never Not Creative podcast. We're on our third and final episode of the F Word mini-series. The F Word is, of course, failure. Sarah, have you failed recently?
On a very micro level, yes. Just when I was putting the kids to bed tonight, my toddler was just being a bit of a pain, if I'll be honest, and I sort of muttered under my breath, "Oh, shut up, Luke." And my daughter heard it and she looked at me and said, "Mom, did you say?" Anyway, I was admonished for that. And then I apologized to her and I said, "I'm sorry, I was just in a bit of a mood." And he didn't hear it though. She's like, "No, but I heard it." I went, "Okay, okay." And then she said, "It's okay. You know, everyone fails. Fail is first attempt in learning." And they had this in a big sign in their classroom. And I thought that was actually quite sweet. So, yes, I did. I slipped up. It doesn't sound like a huge mistake. Probably isn't really from our perspective, but from a seven-year-old's it was. And she told me it was okay.
I was going to say, it's all about perspective.
I know. I went, "I didn't swear." Just like, is that bad? Anyway.
There we go. Okay.
So, yes, a minor moment but I guess that leads us to how failure is important and how we all need to fail, in inverted commas, to keep learning.
Yeah. And so who have we got this episode, V, who's going to talk to us about failure on a kind of organizational level?
So on the third and final episode, David and I are speaking with Trevor Hubbard, the founder of Butcher Shop, the amazing global design agency with offices in Silicon Valley, Mexico, and Austria. And we also brought in the award-winning British transformational leader, Eva Applebaum, to discuss failure at an organizational level. Because even though Sarah talked about her failure tonight, I think this is something, especially in our current climate after the past 2 years and knowing how volatile, or as I love to use the word VUCA, volatile, uncertain, so forth, world we're going to be in, especially after COP26 and all these other things, lovely things, I feel failure at organizational level needs to be embraced even more, or have organizations address it. That's why we end our series on, is at the organizational level.
Mm. And Trevor's become, though, a bit of an expert in trying to do everything not to fail, though, right? That's kind of what he brings to the table.
Don't want to give away too much, but the one thing that really stuck in my brain, and I also took lots of notes on it, was he really emphasized clarity. Because I think not to fail, you need to be clarity. And so many times when you see organizations have issues is because leadership isn't clear. They're not providing clarity to their employees and so forth. So he really emphasized the element of clarity. I know there's going to be a book. He has a working title, but it is around clarity because he definitely does not want to fail, but it's emphasizing the element of clarity when it comes to not failing. So,
yeah, I kind of like it because I think I like the way he talks about it. When we've talked in the past and he talks about how, like, you know, failing fast sometimes can just almost be a bit of a lazy, like, you know, we didn't check everything out beforehand. We just had a crack at it. And guess what? We failed. Whereas, you know, being able to go in with your eyes wide open, thinking about all the things that could go wrong and being comfortable with them if they do, I think is a much better way to talk about at least kind of failing fast.
Indeed. And I agree with you. I feel like the culturally where it's like fail fast and so forth, it definitely is lazy. And it's an excuse, if anything, where organizations just, I've even heard bosses of mine say that. But yet still, things perpetuate and there's still issues because they're not being clear, they're not being transparent. That all plays into it. There's a bigger dialogue around organizational failure. I feel there could be issues like just because something came out of left field, like, well, I went like 9/11 in the early 2000s. That definitely impacted organizations. But for the most part, there should be clarity along the way from leadership from the top down. But especially when you get to organizations that are massive, 20,000, 30,000 people, there is more opportunities for the things to slip through and have failure.
Sarah, what does it make you think of when someone says, "It's okay, you can fail," or, you know, "Fail fast and let's carry on"? Because I think also you're both quite perfectionists.
Yeah, for me, it's a balance between kind of overthinking, But I guess it is that realignment between, okay, there's a certain level where if it's a mistake, then we have to let it go and find out why this mistake happened, rather than going over and over and over again with the aim of not to fail, sort of like being too perfectionist and fearing it so much. And that line is difficult to find. And I constantly, I mean, at stream time, I'm trying to figure it out every day where to put that line, really.
Does regret come up at all in these conversations, V?
Actually, if it did, the one thing I'll have to say, this is probably one of the conversations that I could have just sat back and just listened to them carry on for like several hours. From my recollection, I wish I can say yes, but I don't believe so. It didn't pop up because one topic I did go off on a tangent. I did was able to interject and ask even Eva about being a woman and failure in organizations. And we did touch upon that too. But regret never came up, really. If it was, it was fleeting.
And I'm assuming, obviously, we won't give too much away, but being a woman and failing is quite different to being a man and failing.
Oh, yes.
I know from our Never Not International Women's Day talks, I forget who it was. It might have been Tanara Schneider who talked about how men can fail and, you know, turn around and end up in an even better job with better pay and a better title. Women can fail and, you know, never be seen again. Mm-hmm. Like it's almost so much more brutal.
Exactly. Or even, it's not failure, but even the fact that a study just came out, I was reading, I think it was Forbes, I forgot exactly which business publication was posting this in my feed, but when women try to promote themselves to get a promotion or a salary increase and so forth, that's seen as, it was blatantly, I forgot how it was worded, but it's like negative. But if they're like, oh, this person will be amazing, that was positive. Yet if a man did the same thing of trying to get a salary raise, it'd be like, oh, okay. So I think it's just into failure. It's just double standard. It's just another business double standard. So yeah, unfortunately.
All right, let's get into it then. So we've got David, V, Trevor, and Eva. Enjoy the episode.
Hi, Trevor and Eva. Thank you for joining myself and David today to talk about failure. Really interested in diving in and gleaning insight on failure from both your perspectives, be it an external perspective, Eva, especially now with your consultancy with ARC, and then also internally, Trevor, with as the global CEO of Butcher Shop. But before we dive into that, we'd love to have gained some other insight. So I'm just going to hand it over to David.
Yeah, I mean, we've had two really great sessions with, it was just myself and Vanessa to begin with, chatting quite openly about failure. And then the last session was really interesting because we had a graduate who won our intern scheme, kind of battling it out with somebody who started up their own company. And it was really interesting to get kind of those two opposing ends of the spectrum in terms of somebody who's been through it all and somebody who's coming into it and getting a sense of what failure meant to kind of both of them from different perspectives. So I guess that's probably where it'd be great to start with you both, is almost just get a sense of where are you both, and very top line, what are your feelings around this word and what does it mean to you and what have you experienced in relation to failure?
Okay, so I think that it's a word that doesn't scare me, whereas probably earlier in my career or when I was younger, maybe I had a different perception of it. I also think, though, that it's a word that maybe has become more prominent as we are putting more expectations on ourselves about what we think we need to achieve in life. And so, while this is a very complicated answer, perhaps, I think that in my younger years, when I was early in my career, I probably didn't have a lot. I definitely didn't have a plan and I didn't have expectations. So failure was not something that was on my radar. What was on my radar was to do just good enough that I could travel and socialize and do the things that I wanted to do. As I got older and as culture sort of changed and we became a bit more ambitious around all the things that we were supposed to be actualizing through our work, then failure probably became a more dominant word. And maybe I grappled with it, but I think that I probably still keep it a little bit external from me. I don't really worry about it that much. because I think it's something that you can over-intellectualize what failure is and what it means to you. But actually, you could also take a really big picture perspective and say, failure is just a part of life. And if you're not experiencing ups and downs of life, you're not really living in this world.
Yeah, I share the life's journey approach to failure in the sense that you evolve your relationship to it as you go through the certain phases of your life. To me, failure is the best thing on the planet in the sense that it is your lighthouse, your litmus test for where your sort of gaps in knowledge are, for the assumptions that you made, for the surprises that you end up seeing. And you can start to develop, in my experience, a lot of insight and patterns from the past, right? So that you can use in the future. And I can come at the failure topic from the lens of, you know, running a global agency. I could come at it from, you know, running a venture company. I could come at it from being an entrepreneur. I can come at it from, you know, what our clients are experiencing from brand, business, and product kind of categories. I could approach it personally as a father or in my relationships. But I think the sub part of failure to me has always been, what is clarity? What is the clarity factor? How much clarity do you have on whatever it is that you're doing? And so I think failure and clarity are these two interesting opposing forces, yet somehow they're in bed together. And you can almost sort of start to get prescient about failure as you go through things by thinking about, what am I unclear on? You know, what am I making assumptions about? Where is there a lack of alignment? Where am I guessing? Where am I just sort of, you know, moving fast, right? To just kind of get things done. And from that, I think failures often happen because we focus on the wrong things. We focus on the easy things. We focus on things that really we make lists, right? We're a culture of list makers, and we attack problems and things by going on the list. But usually behavioral psychology teaches us that lists are usually what's top of mind, and we usually default to things that are very easy, right? So we never really move the needle forward, and we end up asking ourselves, well, why did that happen? Well, it's because you were focusing on these easy things just so that you could have that dopamine hit of crossing something off the list, but you never worked on the things that actually move the needle forward. So I think there's one part method, one part mindset, and one part sort of tools that you install to change your relationship and the outcome of what failure is. And I think, you know, a lot of the things that I do in practice are about beating failure rather than thinking as failure as part of the inevitable journey of the entrepreneur, I guess.
Love that. Both of those are really nice answers. And I, it makes me wonder, because before we got into this, I was trying to piece together what we call a bit of a thought piece that we're going to publish on this idea of failure. And actually that then turned into this three-part podcast series, which felt much more interesting and a bit more natural in terms of it becoming a conversation rather than it me kind of overthinking and over-rationalizing what the hell this failure thing is. But I wonder, do you both have a view on whether is failure something personal to you, or is failure about what others think of you? Is society creating a version of what you should be, therefore you're more often than not going to fail because it's about what society believes you should be? Or have you got a different relationship with failure whereby actually failure is just my thing? I don't care what others think.
I think that that is such a personal question, because really different personalities will answer that very differently. I think I am not someone who, I don't know, I never really care terribly what other people think of me, but I will equally give myself very high expectations or high standards that I need to, then I become disappointed if they don't happen. So I don't think that I regard failure as something that is imposed on me from other people, but I would say that if there's an expectation or something that I really wanted and I don't get it, then I it's not like I'm immune to that feeling of disappointment. One thing that I think is really, you know, is quite interesting is that this connection between resilience and failure, and people who tend to have higher resilience probably have a different relationship with failure or can kind of ride through failure easier, whether they experience it or not. And I think I have a, and I would say I don't have a methodology or a theory behind this. I think I am a resilient person because I just happen to be a resilient person. And often people have asked me why I think I'm a resilient person. And I don't really know the story behind that, except for that I think that I probably faced a lot of challenges in a way where I still felt safe enough to overcome them. And that probably built up my resilience over my life. So I think that, you know, I don't want to sound like failure is not a personal thing, because I think that there are so many people who really deeply struggle with it and deeply struggle with feeling like they're good enough or feeling like they've done enough or feeling of feelings of confidence or their own self-worth that's tied up in their perceptions of failure and also tied up with their comparing themselves with other people. But I would also say it's not something that I've personally experienced, but I have a lot of empathy for that.
Yeah, I subscribe to a lot of what Eva's saying, that it is a personal sort of relationship. But I think if we zoom out and we look at kind of the dynamics that go into, you know, people's relationships with failure, there's probably a couple things that I think are important. If I highlight like a company culture, right, and we talk about the relationship to failure within that company, it always goes back to how much clarity is in the organization to me. And if you extrapolate that, it goes into me personally with like, how much clarity do I have, right? And so if you change your relationship where failure is a surprise, it's sort of like, I'm just going to go about this stuff and one day something's going to happen and boom, it's diagnosed as a failure. And now I'm going to be resilient, pick up my bag and move on and keep trudging along. And I think that when you look at organizations and companies and entrepreneurs, it's the relationship that they have with failure. Is it an inevitability? Is it something that just happens? Or do you flip that and say, what am I unclear about? What are the unknowns? What's undiagnosed? Is my plan even really good? How am I going to get people to buy into that plan? How am I going to get people to contribute to that plan? How do I change the plan based on what I hear from other people? And what I think in Silicon Valley, where I'm from, in San Francisco, there's this massive emphasis put on to this phony success metric. And everybody comes to meetings with KPIs and OKRs and this strategy and this plan and let's go execute. And then company culture becomes kale chips and ergonomic chairs and swag and everybody's ready to go. And then you never have a moment to question, well, is that even the right plan? Have I even contributed? Is the plan something I can be a piece of, and maybe come up with my own plan underneath that? So how do you achieve that? And there's an unconfirmed statistic I like to use called 99% of all problems in an organization are a leadership problem. And that's not to make leaders feel bad. It's just to put the emphasis in that a leader's job is one thing, is to maximize clarity and to beat failure. Those two are so intrinsically related to each other. But I don't think anyone knows how to really develop a positive relationship with failure. And so what I subscribe to is this idea that you can look at whatever goal, whatever OKR or KPI you have, and then ask a simple question. What would make this fail? And then ask other people to answer that question as well. And what you get is this diversity of perspective, the unpopular thoughts, these challenges that come from the depths of the organization, from the team. And then you can put those in rank and order, and you can actually get a real strategy based on the priority of the hardest things that'll have the most catastrophic impact. And then you work from there. And what you've just done in that half hour or 10 minutes, or for me, it's just mindset now. What you get is this stress gets alleviated because you now have gone all the way to the future and said, these are the things that could happen. And failure is just those things that you never thought would come. So if you do that critical thinking and you think about that, anything you're facing, whether it's writing a book, a new endeavor, getting a job, you know, getting that promotion, actually pivoting your company, going through growth and transformation, how do you reorganize during a pandemic? What's going to be your pandemic strategy? All of those things are riddled with just these little failures that can happen along the way. So I like to presciently put that on the table and ask that question so that the leadership that I want to stand for is standing for that clarity. And part of clarity is getting so far in front of those failures that everybody has talked about them And then people can develop plans to defend against them. So I'd rather have a team that doesn't bring OKRs and KPIs to the table and say, this is what I did this year. I'd rather have somebody talk to me and say, these are the failures that I beat this year. And that to me is incredibly powerful from a cultural standpoint. So it changes your relationship, I think. And I think that's what Eva was kind of getting to, is like, some people like her probably intrinsically have this kind of, you know, idea in mind where they can kind of quickly size up a situation and move past it because they're already doing that work. Other people that have a really estranged relationship to failure probably don't have that muscle memory. And so you just develop it as a tool. And I firmly believe that anyone can get there because all you're doing is just asking the question, what would make this fail? And it's a very liberating question to ask.
I really agree with everything you're saying. There's one thing that I keep thinking about as you're speaking, which is that the failure as a label is probably something that in and of itself I struggle with. So it's not really a word that I was trying to think, like, in my own experience and my own leadership style and when I advise leaders on the way that they work, is it something that I directly go to, or the language, is it slightly different? And I think it's generally slightly different. I think I would talk about what would get in the way of this working, or what barriers would we face for this? Sometimes we talk about risk, and I'm a trustee at two charities where risk will be much more the emphasis rather than failure. So as you were speaking and you mentioned being from Silicon Valley, I was wondering if that the language, that label of failure is actually something that's come directly from that, where underneath that label, there's a whole myriad of concepts that represent a lot about the culture of Silicon Valley, probably as well, a bit of the bravado of Silicon Valley as well. And thus we talk about failure a lot more. So it's not that failure in itself isn't something that we should talk about. It's that, what do we even mean by failure? And I thought it was really interesting, Trevor, when you said the opposite of failure is clarity. To me, that was a really meaningful, really, really interesting, meaningful insight. The opposite of failure is not success. The opposite of failure is clarity. So if the opposite of failure is clarity, what do we really mean when we're talking about failure? And as leaders, or as people who work with leaders, and in my case, who advise leaders, what help can I give them to make it safe to talk about things that don't work, or to create that culture, that environment that you were describing, where we can mitigate, or we can build that confidence or build that resilience around things that may or may not work? And is it failure per se? Is that the focal point, failure per se? Or is it just unraveling all the things that gets in the way of clarity or gets in the way of what we want to achieve?
You know, it's totally nuanced. And I think it's also semantic, but it's also quite literal when you think of like frameworks and like different ways to approach problem solving, because then you're in a different place. Now you're in problem solving mode, which is part and parcel about unpacking. It's about, you know, brainstorming. It's about figuring different approaches. It's about, you know, then getting into a place of like, what's the risk versus reward on all these things. So I totally subscribe to that. I think you bring up another really good point of like Silicon Valley. I think Silicon Valley is so effed up in the sense that people have this relationship with failure as an inevitability. Entrepreneurs wear it like a badge of honor. You know, like, I had to fail 10,000 times before I landed, struck lightning in a bottle, right? And, you know, you got Zuckerbergs out there saying, like, you know, that like, fail fast, right? And move fast and break things. And there's all these things that I think were heritage to this golden age of building these amazingly successful, large, life-changing companies. And it doesn't work for everyone. We're not there anymore. And so I think Silicon Valley is in rapture with this failure idea, but in the wrong way. I think they think it's inevitable and it's part of what you need to go through. And until you go through that, you're not worth it. And that's why everyone protects themselves against failure and hates that word, shuns away for it. There's a thing, I'm a ski patroller at Squaw Valley in Tahoe, and we look at patients where they pain guard, right? And that's usually where you know the injury is because when you're going through your palpations and you're doing your diagnosis, they pain guard. And you see that same thing happen in Silicon Valley with entrepreneurs, with people in creative careers, where they pain guard against failure. And what they do is they're so afraid of it. They don't ever want to acknowledge it. And what they end up doing is turning small, insignificant things into these large, blown out success stories. And it's really hard to get to whether that had value and impact. And so the reason, you know, Eva, I came through really hard on failure is because I want to get to the goods fast. And I want to change the relationship we have to failure to make it a comfort blanket, to make it something that you have permission to talk about. Failure to me is a release of mental health. Failure to me is diagnosing these things that we often sugarcoat. And so for me to be controversial, I'm anti the Silicon Valley mindset, trying to pull failure into this positive light of something that we can all sit around a table and look at and talk about. And so the book that I'm working on is called You Suck at Clarity, not Beat Failure, but it's the idea of how it's how we get to the goods, right? Like you said, it's that clarity relationship, but clarity is the thing that we all want. Removing the failures and having a great relationship with failure is the path to get there. And so that's why I don't use things like risk or risk mitigation or, you know, trying to unpack those things. I just want to go straight to the heart of what I've diagnosed is the biggest elephant in the room, right? And it's talking about failure in a positive way.
Wow.
I think it's been really interesting listening to both of you. And it you then start asking a different question in my head, and it isn't the theme of today, but you then go to, well, what does success mean? Because actually, you always talked about the two opposing ends of failure and clarity. And then you then have this idea of success as well, which I think for many people, if you're not successful, you feel like a failure. And therefore, maybe that's from a very early age where it comes from.
But on that topic, you can have the picture of success. Just people just put that in a box and think they're going to get there with their haphazard strategy. That's fine. I think in order for failure to even happen, you have to have some vision of success. So you start there. You start and say, what is the apple of my eye? Where do I want to be? Where do we want to be? What does success look like? Bam. That's a wonderful thing to have. And what are the goals I have? Great. Then ask the question, what's the risk? Like Eva was saying, what's the failure points? What would prevent us from getting there? People don't do that enough. They don't. Like, I can say I want to sell my company for $250 million in 3 years, right? That's what I want. But what do I have to do to get there? What are the possible failure points? Is it people? Is it culture? Is it value and impact? Is it client? Is it business pipeline? Is it fitting a profile that the outside market would see value in? Is it, you know, handling a decentralized workforce in a way that is empowering? Is it all these things that are under the hood of that success metric? Usually founders and strategy people, they run the numbers. They're like, we need to get here, ARR, we need to do this, we need to do that, we need to go raise a round. And it's like, yeah, but what would prevent you from doing that? And so success gets much more attainable if you can figure out that path. And then much more important to that, can you bring, in my company, 115 people along with you? And then can they contribute in a way that gets you to that mountaintop? And that to me is the biggest crux that we face and how we have to figure out that equation. So you can't have failure without a picture of success. You can't have success without thinking about the failures. And that's kind of how I look at that relationship. I don't know, Eve, if you agree with that, but
I completely agree, but I want to add something because I think also that, you know, in the industry that you work in, there's probably less of a risk of risk, right? In the fact that the risk may be that you don't sell your company for $250 million, but what you're not doing is falling foul of major regulation. You're not having massive safeguarding issues. You're not getting scandal. You know, there's a lot of things that you're not having to deal with. Now, when I work with companies in other industries, there is a different kind of failure success type of balancing act that has to happen that I think in a way, you know, you're fortunate. I think in that culture of Silicon Valley, you haven't yet, you will be at a certain point, you will be coming up against this, but you haven't yet been born into that type of world where you also have to think about the things that can go catastrophically wrong. A lot of industries I work with, they're either highly regulated or, you know, like an airline, an international development charity, you know, there are things that can go catastrophically wrong. And therefore, there are areas where it's not just about how do we get success? It's also about how do we create a culture where the things that can go wrong, that we're managing them appropriately and that we have the right safeguards or we have the right controls around them so that we're not creating catastrophically horrible things. And so as I was listening to you, I was thinking, I agree with everything that you were saying, but it was almost like there was half a conversation that I didn't hear you mention yet. And I think it's possibly because, you know, that aspect of it isn't so prominent in every industry. Every type of sector will have, you know, different areas that they're concerned about. So what I find in a lot of my clients, a lot of the businesses I work with, they're that what falls on the, you know, oh my God, that better never happen kind of side of the page is as big as the how are we going to be successful side. And a lot of work and effort has to go into how do you balance then culture that needs to be both very respectful of the things that you need to make sure don't happen, as well as very open to the areas where you need to be, you want to keep people open-minded and innovative enough that they can do things differently, that they are willing to take risks, that they're happy with failure. And it's not as easy a balance as you think, because you're kind of having to send two messages at the same time. And so when we talk about conversations about these things, there'll be frameworks that have to both balance, where are we looking at, where is it safe for failure and where is it not safe for failure, right? And where is the most important thing, where is success measured by, you know, where is success about what we've achieved, how we've grown, and where is success measured by it didn't happen, right? You know, it's a completely different thing. And in there, what's interesting, I think, is that from when you said 99% of problems in organizations or 99% of how organizations can live or die is about leadership. I think what's interesting is that the leadership behavior you need for both those things are actually the same, right? You need to create a culture where there is that psychological safety, where people feel they're able to raise issues, where they're able to admit that something's gone wrong, they're able to admit they don't know or that they have concerns. You need to have also that clarity that you talked about, that absolute clarity of what's expected, what you're trying to do. You need to have leaders who role model what it is that you want, right? So the leaders who are also embodying the behavior that you're expecting from everyone else. And whether you, as a leader, are trying to pull in the direction of let's embrace failure so that we can do things differently, or let's mitigate against failure so that we can succeed, versus let's make sure that we have the strongest possible governance and safeguarding and risk control so that these things don't happen. The leadership style, I think the culture is developed through having that openness and having that, as you said, you know, having the conversations in the open and making it safe for people to come back to you with their own feelings and concerns about it.
Yeah, it's great.
I'm listening to both of you and the word leadership comes up quite a lot. And I wonder whether you've got a view on how good are today's leaders? Are they getting it right? Are they getting it wrong? Is that a hard one to answer? Because we've had a few debates and one thing that came up again and again is that the more senior you become, you kind of get into a role or you're promoted into a role where you've had no formal training to get there. You've just kind of naturally progressed up that ladder and suddenly you're in this role and you kind of go, nobody's really told me how to do this. So I wonder whether leadership's actually quite a tough thing because you've arrived at that position, but nobody's formally taught you how to get there or what to do when you arrive in that position. So does that throw up an interesting kind of question around what do leaders have to do to get better at being leaders to mitigate failure or embrace failure or create this more open environment as a culture where failure can just be openly talked about in the right way?
I mean, to me, it's simply four things. And I think to qualify everything, I mean, this year alone, we've worked with 16, you know, unicorns that have each been valued at billions of dollars. So the growth and transformation projects we're working on with them follow the same sort of approach of beating failure. And similar to what Eva's saying, a lot of the client partners that we work with, you know, we're not figuring out their pivot strategies in compliance and governance and things like that. But what we are doing is figuring out the relationship between brand, business, and product, right? So there's a lot of things in there. And most of our clients are C-suite type folks. And one thing that I've always found as my four sort of metrics or to use this again, my litmus test to gauge not only the relationship, but also the quality of what I think we can do together and that impact and value and outcome are really just kind of four things. I think one, empathy. Is empathy there? To me, that is the highest quality in a declared leader or a non-declared leader. Is that there? I think the second one is eliminating fear. Do they stand for that, right? Do they have a relationship with fear that is positive, that can bring people forward? The third one is clarity. What is the matrix of their relationship with clarity? How much clarity is in their organization? Do they throw things over the transom? Do they try to work as far and fast as they can to get things just perfect enough, but then they've wasted 3 months of not bringing anyone along? So everyone has 6 minutes to get in shape for it. Like, that's bad, right? So what's the threshold of clarity? I call it the 6 hours versus 6 minute equation. And then I think the other one, which is different, it may sound the same because they may be synonyms, but they're not, is transparency. How transparent is information in a culture with a leader? So I look at the four of those things as qualities to leaders, but also with our client partners. And it's probably why nobody in our company was hired as a leader. They were hired as good people that are empathetic, that really are standing for eliminating fear, that value clarity at all costs, and that are incredibly transparent. And that's what's made us had our most successful years during the pandemic. That's what's made us have great relationships with our clients. And so I guess that's the four things. It doesn't answer your question, but those are the things that I think the modern leader needs to be. And it's less about command and control. It's less about hierarchy. It's less about management style. It's more of just, do they have those four things? You're probably going to be great. And most people that don't want to be leaders or managers are the best ones. They're the best because they didn't want to do it, but they're really good at it, right? So I think that's another thing too, where you invite people on that journey rather than go find them.
Yeah, I really agree again with what you're saying. I think that there's been such an interesting shift in the last, and it's actually been more recent. If I think back, it's not been that long, maybe 5 years even, where we're starting to talk so much more in mainstream discussions around empathetic leaders, leaders who are authentic, leaders who are open and vulnerable even. These weren't words that you really heard that much about leaders. You know, even if we go back maybe 5 years, there were academic studies about it, or you could read an HBR article about the importance of it. But what's interesting, I think with the, certainly during the pandemic, there was a realization that leadership with empathy had much more weight to it in times of crisis than command and control leadership. With there's the myriad of challenges that organizations are now facing around, you know, you've got future of work, you've got, you know, disruptive technology, you've got sustainability, you've got now the need to show diversity and inclusion, you've got there's this huge complexity of things, and a command and control type of leadership persona just doesn't work in this world. It's not going to get you what you need. What you need is, exactly as you said, empathetic leaders who have that kind of clarity of vision and have that openness to how they lead, that they're very open and accessible too, probably. What I would add to it is I think that there's a really interesting mix that I always talk about where you need leaders who can be vulnerable and have empathy and kind of show emotion around work or show sort of caring around work in a way that we wouldn't have really looked to in leaders years ago. But it also still needs to be balanced with a high challenge from the leaders. So it's not just, I'm empathetic, I care about my people, and I want to show that my brand or my organization is caring and has purpose, everything else. But there also needs to be a level of high expectation and high challenge for what you expect people to do. And that mix between giving people a clear vision that is a challenging and stretching one, together with a very empathetic, open, human kind of approach, I think is the winning formula right now for a leader to get us through, you know, during the time that we're in right now, where it's so, you know, it's really tough, right? It's really, really tough.
I'm just like listening to both your comments going back and forth. I'm like, there's a question, but then something else comes up. So hopefully I'm not going backwards too much, but I love just coming from corporate America, working in Fortune 500 companies, just hearing your list, Trevor, of like the litmus test is amazing. But what comes to mind though, is so much, I remember I was at the beginning of a transformation at one of the companies and one of the C-suite executives was saying, oh, we're going to bring in human-centered design to our vernacular. We're going to do this. So I brought it up. I questioned him on that. He did not know that what HCD really was about. He did not know that. It was more of I guess you could say a shelf life, or as one of those, you know, of the moment words. And that's the one thing reflecting upon, you know, I'm just blown away by this, but reflecting upon looking at the holistically looking across the sector, so many, I'm like, being able to be empathetic, is it overused by some of the leaders? Do they just use that to say that to sort of tick the box and be like, oh, okay, I'm in the clear. My question is though, what needs to be done in this sector to be able to translate that over and bring that empathy, bring the your litmus test into cultures, into organizations across the board? Because when I stand back, I'm like, yes, you see companies starting to change, but really, is it just ticking the box? Is it to appease our shareholders and so forth? But from your opinion, like, how can we actually make that shift?
Yeah. Empathy for a lot of people is like a checkbox, right? Was I empathetic? Check, right? I think it's a practice. And one of the best ways to put that into practice is say that I am being empathetic if I do these things. If I remove any blockers for people to do their job, I am being empathetic. If I am speeding up things so that people can do their best work, I am being empathetic. If I am creating an organization where clarity is the most important thing, I am being empathetic. If I am confronting the hard problems and solving them with people, I am being empathetic. Empathy does not mean kowtowing. It doesn't mean listening to the people and giving them the word they want to hear. It doesn't mean sending a thank you note. Empathy also means giving credit where credit is due. I think one of the biggest things we have a problem with in organizations, a lot of the companies that we work with, is it always seems sort of like it's manufactured culture, right? It's not something that is organic or intrinsic. And I think it has to come from the leadership, the people that are cutting the red wire or the blue wire, making that decision. What is their relationship to this concept and this practice? And recognition is right there. You can learn a lot from a leader with how they give recognition to employees, to their team, right? And I feel like those are little things where you don't look at like, was that empathetic? You look at it more of like, do they do those things? So even when you're interviewing or in a job, asking those questions of like, how does your CEO or other managers give recognition in the company? Great question. No one's ever asked that, you know? But you can really gauge a culture by changing the way that you are making a decision by kind of assessing those things that go into what empathy is. That's just that word, but I do think you're right. It's as convoluted, bastardized, and misunderstood as the word brand. So I'm right there with you as far as what empathy means or doesn't mean.
Have you heard of this leading from the back of the room concept? So your role as a leader is not to be the center of the organization, but your role as a leader to be in the back of the room, enabling and empowering other people to do their work or do their best work and creating the conditions for them to work in and removing the barriers, giving them the clarity, but then leaving them alone. And that, I think, is in a way that may be an easier concept to have conversations around than just empathy, as empathy is almost empathy becomes one of those labels like failure, where underneath it, there's a lot of nuance. But
exactly,
when you talk about what's underneath it and what the behaviors that are the sort of the organizing principles that you would have to consider if you're looking at building empathy in an organization, then things like servant leadership, I think, becomes more. It's easier to wrap your head about how do you translate that into what do you actually need from me? And I think often exactly we do sort of tell people like, well, we want diversity and empathy and we want, you know, these big labels, and everyone goes and says, okay, well, I need to learn how to be more empathetic. So I'm just going to say, I care. And at the end of the day, you don't actually get the change. It doesn't really do much. Whereas if you break things down into really what is the behavior? So if you're saying that you want X, what is the Y behavior that you need to display every day, that you need to embody all the time in order to get there? These become better catalysts for change and change of leadership.
We've arrived at the same point, that empathy is this massive umbrella, but it really is what you pack in that, that actually is the action. And empathy is not a word or a descriptor, it's an action. And so the more that you can think of empathetic actions that have value and impact, I think then you're on your path to defining that for yourself. But that to me feels right.
I wish more leadership within the creative sector would take empathy as an action instead of just ticking the box. But one thing, Eva, you said when you're talking, just and talking about servant leadership, it just reminded me of this one experience when I first was introduced to servant leadership. It was like a decade ago in San Francisco at a symposium for the Die Line. And David Turner was talking with Vince Barr on there. And he was making a comment about the best creative director he has at the time. She is in the back of the room and allowing her team to rise. And I love the fact that he highlighted that it was a female and not just saying he, because so many times it's always like, just think leadership male, just traditionally. So I do have a question. I hopefully I'm not going too much off topic, but my question is, as you worked in-house at BBC and other companies, and then also now as a consultant and as a female, seeing how failure is approached for women within organizations. I know Dave and I were just talking before, and I was relaying an anecdote from one of the companies I worked with. And I said, if a woman had been in that role, she would have been out the door. So I'm just wondering, how have you seen that sort of dynamic in your experience? And I'm sorry for remembering this too.
Oh, there's like a whole other 2-hour podcast that we can talk about.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, like it or not, women leaders hold a different space in organizations, and they're called on also at different times. And one thing I think is the glass cliff. It's when there's a crisis or there's something really going wrong in a business is often when they bring in a female leader. So I think that there is this strange, you know, really, really strange paradox that in times of crisis, we actually are more likely to bring in women as leaders. But the paradox of that is that then the blame is also going to sit on the shoulders of the women when the crisis is so deep that the business cannot be pulled out of it by parachuting a female leader in. And equally, I think what you said before about the fact that the expectations on women leaders, in not in the times of crisis, but just in general, I think that the tolerance for failure, the tolerance for radical innovation, the tolerance for all those things is much different than when you have a male at the helm. But I think women embody different things. So what's interesting is, now that there's a lot of emphasis on sustainability and inclusiveness and everything else, I think that this is where women do embody that a bit better. So there's an opportunity for female leaders to step into those roles because it's more believable in a way that if you're trying to create a culture that is more inclusive, more empathetic, more sustainable, etc., you're with servant leadership and everything else, that having a female leader embodies that in a way that, not that a male leader can't, but it just embodies it a bit more. It becomes more symbolic. I'm working right now with Grey Advertising, and they've brought in Laura Jordan Bumbach as the president. And her leadership persona is so naturally inclusive and empathetic and so forth that I think in a way they don't, it's not that they don't also have policy or they don't also need all those things, but I think that just her symbolism in that role is starting to be the catalyst for a new culture there. So there is something about that, the pros of female leadership. The cons are that the tolerance for us effing things up is a lot lower, you know, a hell of a lot lower. And it's not a badge of honor. You know, I mean, no one's looking at Theresa May right now to talk about what she learned from the absolute shit show that they put, you know, that she had to deal with over that. Whereas I'm sure that Boris Johnson will come out of this with flying colors, right? But there's a different kind of, we can't hold that failure and sort of wave it around as a flag in the way that I think male leaders can.
Do you think there's something interesting thinking about this more around, I'm just throwing a thought out there, kind of co-leadership where you maybe get the best of both? So we've kind of gone, women offer this, men maybe offer something different. Is there a holy grail of what the right type of leadership is in terms of a balance?
Yeah.
Is it more about the individual and what they are?
Yeah, it's really simplistic to say female this, male this. So I'm not necessarily saying I believe that, but I think that it would be naive not to admit that there is these perceptions and there is this, you can't totally ignore it either.
Yeah, it's interesting. I try to look at myself of like, when have I arrived as being a leader? And it's when I'm replaceable. And it's a very strange thing to kind of like say that, because you have to have a relationship where my job, and I think a lot of leaders struggle with this, their job isn't to have all the answers, right? Their job is to create a space where people can do that, right? And so if I am slowly replacing myself out of all the things that I do, that's a good measuring stick of a great company. Our leadership, we're 80% female leadership, and I don't know if that's by design. But I do think it's really interesting that when you talk about co-leadership, if it's true that you're, as a CEO, your job is to become obsolete as a metric of a successful run company, and the people that are doing that work are all female, there's something to be said for that and how much things are changing. I've just seen agencies and companies that are good old boys clubs. I've seen the industry that has drastic, like catastrophic, toxic sort of things that happen in it. And to me, you know, creating a company where DIE, as everyone says, or diversity, inclusivity, and equity, all of these things are not words, but you live it, is really hard. But it's also the mission if you make it, because when you see it on the other side, it's a whole different world. We went out and acquired an agency in Guadalajara. The team down there, 65, I think now 85 people, hadn't had access to the US, hadn't been traveling to New York, hadn't been going to LA, hadn't been flying to Vienna for a leadership summit. Tying their boat to our boat is one of those things where you start to see this rise of this middle class kind of happening in Guadalajara, and you start to see all the different things. I think one of the founders of the company we acquired, I asked, why are you doing this? Why are you letting us acquire you? Why do you want to do this? And I think one conversation, I was in the car driving and the deal wasn't going well, and we got it back on track because he said, because I want my kids to go to Stanford. And that was not possible without that. So to me, that was immediate. I'm like, bam, we're doing this. Like, we're making this happen. So, you know, we're all circling around these topics, but I just think, again, like the word empathy, it's a big umbrella. But how do you break those ceilings, the glass cliff, all these things that we're talking about, practice servant leadership? You got to stand for it. You got to make it part of like what you firmly believe in. If you do that, you can sniff that out pretty quick if it's inauthentic. But that to me is, you know, you either have it or you don't. You can't manufacture it, right? And usually you see massive regime change when you have, you know, bigger companies or publicly traded companies with the board, you know, making some of these decisions to bring companies into the 21st century. I mean, it's time. It's already been time. Time's expired. It's go time now.
I was just thinking as you were talking that in some ways, I think the act of choosing your leader or appointing leaders or leadership team, it's almost like casting for a film, right? Where you think, well, we need this type of person. What actors will be able to really authentically kind of portray that, you know, the baddie, the hero, the love interest, whatever. And I guess that what I was saying before, but I think you can't totally ignore the fact that there is an element of casting when you think about who you put in a leadership role. You're choosing someone that's going to embody something, and it's naive to sort of say, well, that doesn't happen at all. Of course it happens, right? We need the steady hand. We need the person to guide us through change. We need the disruptive innovator, whatever. And then who do we see that embodies that? I think that where, you know, Trevor, what you're sort of alluding to is that we have to acknowledge that and acknowledge also the importance of that, that casting the right type of leader at the right time is important, and that there's a style of leadership that businesses definitely need at certain points. That the difference now is that we also have to make sure that we see people as able to be those roles, regardless of what their background is, or regardless of who they, you know, what they look like, or who they are, or how old they are, whether they're male or female. You know, this the same way, like, can there be a female Bond kind of conversation is exactly, in a way, that's not that different from, you know, can you have a disruptive, innovative female leader who's allowed to fail? I think it's the same transition that we're sort of going through culturally, that yes, of course you can, why couldn't you? But we still have to acknowledge that there is a character type that we're looking for, right? And that that is still important in terms of leadership.
It's been a really, really amazing debate. It's been lovely hearing both of your reactions to the questions. And I want it to be lovely just to get from both of you just a closing thought on this theme of topic of failure before we kind of wrap up this session. So, Trevor?
Wrapping it up. Okay. Full disclosure, failure and beating failure is intrinsically rooted in my company. It's how we approach our business development. It's how we approach methodology. We spent $1 million building our own app called Prio, P-R-I-I-O. It goes through pre-mortem processes in a digital format to allow sort of more virtual engagements on these types of topics. Writing the book called You Suck at Clarity. Working title, guys and gals. And it's something that has guided us through very critical moments during our company's history. At Butcher Shop, you know, going through a partner buyout 3.5 years ago, starting the pandemic, now coming out of the pandemic, acquiring companies, you know, we're now in 3 countries and 8 cities. Growing a team by 30% in a year is a lot. And so when you size all this up, I try to live the truth, right? And become a student and an expert and try to gain as much knowledge as possible. So to me, just keep the relationship where failure happens when there's a lack of clarity. And if you can focus on that and make things that are unclear more clear, I think that's a very nice start. So maybe that changes to bookend this, where your lists aren't things of tasks. Maybe they're things on about things that you need to get clear on.
Okay, my closing thoughts, hard to follow. So I'll go to a different place then. I think that we have to really think about the label of failure and what we really mean by it. And I think that we have to sort of accept that, you know, I'm also a mother, let's say. I haven't mentioned this before, but I think with my children, of course, I want to remove all hardship and all adversity and all barriers in their lives. But I also really realistically and pragmatically know that if they have a childhood without facing any adversity, hardship, or challenges, they will not be a human being ready for this world. So we have to have, you know, we have to understand really that balance between those two things. That, and Trevor, it's not, I completely agree with what you said before, that you can create organizational cultures that tries to remove the, you know, mitigates against failure and turns failure into, uses clarity and everything else. But I think that having expectations that can also accept the fact that things will not always go the way that you want, and learning as a leader, as an organization, as a human, as a parent, as a friend, everything else, that sometimes things just, you know, sometimes things just fail. And that's part of life. I think that teaches you, it gives you a lot as a human, and it gives you a lot over your lifetime. And it teaches you, it, even in, you know, in the work context as well, like knowing which battles to fight, knowing to put where to put your efforts, understanding how to deal with it, understanding what success looks like, knowing what not to worry about, because you just can't, you're not going to be able to change it. So you're going to put it in it. You're going to move around it rather than trying to go through it. All of those lessons are things that we learn over and over again through our life by facing up to things that didn't work out. And therefore, in our working life and in our work culture and in our organizations, we have to balance that wanting to completely eradicate it with all of the great things that we talked about, with also accepting that to a certain degree, it gives us a lot as well.
Love that.
Brilliant. Two lovely ways to close the topic for today. Brilliant. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for our F Word mini-series. Thanks to Trevor, thanks to Eva, David, and of course, thanks to V over in London who put this whole thing together. What a fantastic job. That's also it for 2021. So you'll find that we have loaded them in pretty quickly at the end of this year. So two mini-series in about 2 months. So if you've missed any, or you've missed our Creative and Football mini-series, or you've missed a couple of the episodes at the beginning of this one, take your time over Christmas and get back into the podcast, because we'll be back. We'll take a few weeks off in January and we'll be back with a new season. Final shout out for the empathy survey. Go to nevernotcreative.org/empathy. Take part if you haven't already. Maybe Christmas is the perfect time, or the sort of holiday time, to be able to go and just grab 10 minutes and fill that in. Thanks to Streamtime, healthier creative businesses do use Streamtime to manage their projects, invoice their clients, schedule their teams. Go check out streamtime.net, and thanks to all their support. And thank you everyone who's listened this year to the podcast. Thanks for sharing it, thanks for your feedback, and thanks especially to all of the guests that have come on the podcast over the last 12 months. It's been a great year and we're looking forward to lots more next year. Go check out nevernotcreative.org to see what's going on. Have a great holiday period.